This is the State of Things, broadcasting from Triad Stage in Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. With a history lesson, here's what you learned if you went to school here in North Carolina. Some of the textbooks will start with the Lost Colony and then go to the Revolutionary War. Stuff happens, then there's the Civil War, and then the Greensboro sit-ins, and oh, I forgot the Wright brothers. There it is, North Carolina history in a nutshell, according to your textbook. But there is so much that got left out, and today we're going to try to fill in a little bit of that history with a little bit of context as well. And to lead us in that effort is Professor Arwin Smallwood. He's the chair of the Department of History and Political Science at North Carolina A&T State University. Arwin is going to host a discussion on early racial blending this Sunday on the grounds of Airmount as part of the Outlandish Hillsboro Festival, and he joins us now. Arwin Smallwood, welcome to the State of Things. Thank you. There's my thumbnail sketch of North Carolina history, but of course we left out a lot, including a lot of the mixing that went on with European, Native American, and African Americans who were on this soil for centuries. How to start? Why don't we start with, let's start with the Tuscarora War. If you can tell us a little bit about what that was, and that'll ground us, and we can move forward from there.
Okay. I think in most North Carolina history classes at the college level or, you know, high school level, they do address the Tuscarora War. And in that war, basically what they're, you know, discussing is the fact that that was a major conflict between the natives here in North Carolina and the settlers. And once the war has ended, North Carolina is opened up to settlement.
We're talking about 1711 here, just to put places in time.
That's correct.
Right?
The war is from 1711 to 1713. So it's clear that that group of Indians was very significant and that it was an impediment to the development and growth of North Carolina as a British colony. And so that war is seen as the pivotal event in North Carolina history, which after that war, the coastal plains opened up and pretty much North Carolina has opened up. And as you know, we begin to see tobacco plantations being developed. And of course, tobacco builds the state of North Carolina. And at that time, the colony of North Carolina.
All right. And so tell us more about the Tuscarora, what we know about their origins and how they got to North Carolina.
Well, during the early colonial period, they were a very secretive people and a very secretive nation. So although John Letter and John Lawson explored and went out into, you know, the backcountry and made some contact with them, the Europeans knew very little about the Tuscaroras. But the Tuscaroras were Iroquoian people, and they were connected to the Five Nations, or what became known as the Iroquois Confederacy. The native name is Haudenosaunee, is what they're called. And their origins, of course, are in the Mississippi River Valley. They say orally that they pretty much started at the ancient city of Cahokia. They migrated east, what we call the Five Nations, the Mohawks, the Oneidas, the Onondagas, the Cayugas, and the Senecas, settled in New York State, what is today New York State. And they still have reservations in Western New York State and some in Canada, and that's another story. They split during the Revolution. The Tuscaroras branched off from them during that migration east, and they headed into North Carolina. And they ended up following the river systems, the Roanoke in particular, down into eastern North Carolina, and then began to settle in eastern North Carolina along the mouths of all of the major rivers, pretty much from the Roanoke River down to the Cape Fear. So everything pretty much from the coastal areas of North Carolina up into the Piedmont, and they say at one time to the mountains, was their territory.
And they still maintained close relationships with the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois Confederacy, but really were now substantially different in language and customs by now.
Exactly. And again, it's one of the interesting things about North Carolina history. We know very little, or very little is discussed in North Carolina history about them, but in Virginia, Pennsylvania, New York, you know, there's a great deal of information about not just the Five Nations and the Iroquois Confederacy, but also the Tuscarora's relationship with them. And that relationship, again, we often say, well, they migrated north, which they did after the war, but there was contact with them even before that, because we know before the war, they had petitioned the governor of Pennsylvania as early as 1708, 1709, to leave North Carolina because of conflicts with the colonists, particularly the kidnapping of their women and children and selling of them into slavery. And that was a major complaint that the Tuscarora had against the colonists moving down from Virginia into eastern North Carolina. And they wanted to go and settle with their kin in the North, whom they had maintained a great relationship and trading partnership with and military alliance with for many years prior to the arrival of Europeans.
And you have a personal history with the Tuscarora, having grown up in Bertie and in an area where there's still a strong presence. Tell us about that.
Well, the reason I became interested in this is because I grew up in an area called Indian Woods in Bertie County. Today it's a township, but it was a reservation given to the Tuscarora Indians in 1717 after the Tuscarora War. And so, of course, many of the families there clearly were, although they considered themselves African-American, were of mixed heritage. You know, you could clearly see that they were blended people and mixed people. And people just took it for granted. You know, I mean, that was just who they were. Both sides of my family are from there going back hundreds of years, my mother and father's family. So when I went to college, I took a North Carolina history textbook, and although not a whole lot is talked about early Native people before the arrival of the English, they did mention Leffler and Newsom's famous book on the history of North Carolina. They mentioned my community by name, Indian Woods. And at that point, it struck me that if this community is significant enough to be mentioned in the North Carolina, the great North Carolina history textbook by name, then it must be significant. And that's when I began to do research to find out more about who these people were, found out they were Tuscaroras. Many people were saying Cherokee, but they were Tuscaroras, and then finding out the history of the Tuscaroras.
What about the conversations in your family in that community in terms of identification? How did you identify, and was there much conversation about these other identities and cultures that were historically part of your own?
It was just understood. We were family. You know, everybody was family. People had been from that community for hundreds of years. Like I said, going back, before slavery, but since slavery, both my mother's family and my father's family, churches were established at the end of slavery, and so all of the people are buried at the church. Prior to that, my grandfather would take me through the landscape, and there are slave cemeteries and there are Indian burial grounds. And so he would show me where the slave cemeteries and Indian burial grounds were. It was just understood we were family. So it was never, people considered themselves, because that's how the state of North Carolina identified people, as, colored people, as, Negroes or African Americans. But if you go through census records and you look at early census records, you'll see that many of the people were referred to, particularly before the 1930 census, but the 1920, 1910, as mulattoes. And we also know that if you're using the term mulatto, that means a mix. And oftentimes, if you go way back to colonial times, you'll know that mulatto was often used to describe mixes between Indians and blacks, as well as Indians and whites. It was kind of a universal catchphrase before we moved to Negro and then people of color.
And what's interesting is along the way, and depending on where you are on the timeline, how you self-identify has important political and economic significance. You have to know whether you want to identify as Native American or Indian or African American, or even pass for white if you can. Talk about all the complexity in terms of those identifications, self-identifications.
Well, one of the things about the Tuscarora in terms of their old history, which goes back to first contact, and you mentioned the lost colony before, so I want to at least get a plug in there for this. Most people will have heard of the lost colony, but very few people will have ever heard of Drake's 600. That Sir Francis Drake, a year before the colonists in 1586, brought over 600 African, West African Moors, Maroons, who had assisted him in attacking Spanish islands in the Caribbean and seizing gold and silver for England. He brought them to Roanoke Island and released them and gave them their freedom. And many of those people ended up blending with the Indian populations of eastern North Carolina. If you know the history of eastern North Carolina and early exploration, which started in 1584, you know that the English spread disease, which decimated the local tribes throughout the coastal areas of North Carolina, particularly the Alligator Swamp and the Great Dismal in the Outer Banks. So these men that were brought in, and they were all men mostly, maybe a couple of women, but mostly men, pretty much blended in with those Indian populations. So groups like the Matamiskete, the Muchapungas, the Bear River Indians, and even other groups that still exist in eastern North Carolina, like the Choanokes, have a mixed heritage. And the Tuscaroras also, when we talk about the lost colony, clearly they were absorbed by the Indians. The colonists could not have existed and survived, and the Tuscaroras have always claimed the responsibility of absorbing those people. And they had a unique characteristic. Unlike their kinsmen to the north, they had what was called the Tuscarora eye. Many, many members of the nations had blue eyes, green eyes, and gray eyes. And even as they mix with Africans and African slaves, they still possess this eye. And you'll see families in that region in Bertie County in Indian Woods, the Freemans, the Rascals, the Bonds, the Gillums, all of whom, you know, clearly are mixed people with green eyes, blue eyes, and gray eyes. And pretty much wherever the Tuscarora settle, you'll see what we call the Tuscarora eye amongst the people, whether they intermarry with African Americans or whether they intermarry with whites.
And this was something that was identified as well by colonial military officials as well, something that they used as an identifying mark.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. Chief Brant, who basically during the Revolutionary War, Mohawk chief, would often point out that you could tell the Tuscaroras. Tuscaroras fought with the Americans and with the British, as did other members of the Five Nations. They split during the war. And you have reservations in Canada, Grand River Reservation south of Toronto, and you have the, well, multiples, but you have Ganawage outside of Montreal, but you have a number of reservations, Six Nations reservations scattered throughout Canada, and those were the Iroquois who supported the British during the Revolution. And then in New York State, you have the Seneca Reservation, the, you know, the Oneidas and the Tuscaroras outside of Niagara Falls, New York, who supported the Americans.
Yeah, there are, as you say, Tuscaroras who are up in that region of North America. And you mentioned Drake 600. This is a fascinating story, and I'd like to spend a little bit more time with it. First of all, how do we know anything about it? And then how do we know so little about 600 people who may have been left behind on Drake's, you know, pirate missions, although since he was working for the government, his piracy was then rewarded with a knightship. That's how things work if you do state-sponsored terrorism. But go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, perhaps there is a map at Brown University that captures the actual voyage that was painted during the time that shows, you know, the fleet of ships that left England, came along the west coast of Africa into the Caribbean and the various islands that, you know, were, you know, attacked. And, of course, Drake's, you know, records, you know, speak to it as well. So we do have a documentary, you know, documents to talk about this. Now, after he leaves North Carolina, in terms of what happened to the 600, in North Carolina history, it has not been of great interest. I mean, what we tend to be interested in, I tell my students all the time, if you don't write your history, nobody else will. Right. But I am inclusive. I'm a person who believes in learning truths, right, and trying to find out all I can find out from everyone. But the early North Carolina scholars were mostly interested in the great governors, you know, the great military folks, you know, how they tamed the landscape, you know, how they conquered what was a wilderness, although we know it was not a wilderness, that there were native peoples who had a great civilization there and living there and prospering there. And all the things that native people taught them, again, about tobacco, about the Three Sisters, corn, beans, and squash, about the potatoes, you know, white potatoes and so forth, all the things that native people taught the English so that they could survive in North Carolina and thrive are not really talked about, or they're minimized. And so, and I say this to folks quite candidly, we look at Bertie County, if we look at our state, and we look at the, and it's similar with Virginia as well, but if you look at the history of our state, especially with DNA today, you will find that many people who are native North Carolinians, who can trace their ancestry back to this era, to the 1600s and 1700s, whether they're white, black, or Native American, they're gonna have some combination of all three heritages. It's just inescapable. Many people in Bertie County, African Americans, are coming up triracial. Many whites who have passed for whites for generations are coming up triracial. So you have what we call triracial isolates, people who have always been identified as being mixed race, like the Melungeons in the mountains of North Carolina, Tennessee, and Kentucky, and then other mixed race groups that are scattered throughout the state. But you can look at any population of people. We can just look at our population if you're a native North Carolinian, and you can see and tell that, you know, there's the mixed heritage. And that's not even talking about culturally, in terms of the foods that we eat and our basic behaviors and the ways in which we act, how much Native people have influenced all of the peoples in the state of North Carolina.
Is there a way to go back now and kind of pull the threads apart and find out the impact of that influence? I mean, again, we absolutely dismiss the powerful diplomatic and sophisticated diplomatic and trade relations that Native tribes and groups had. The Confederacy so impressed Franklin, Benjamin Franklin, that he thought our Constitution should be based on their Confederacy. So clearly a sophisticated diplomatic and trade system. How much of it can we, because we tell ourselves the story that thank God we got here and imposed some order on this thing because it was a mess. Well, so can we tell now?
Well, actually, nothing could be further from the truth. And I often point out to folks in my early American history classes. So I'm going to come back to Benjamin Franklin, because a really great book, which there are only ever 200 copies of the book ever printed, Benjamin Franklin's Indian Treaties. And in this book, they're the collection of treaties with the Five Nations and the Indians of the Northeast. I first was exposed to it as a fellow at the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia. And it is very comprehensive, and it's very clear that oftentimes scholars will argue, well, no, our form of government and our democracy is, based in Europe, it's based, but you have to understand that at the time of exploration, we were in a period of absolute monarchies. And they did not believe in democracy. So where did even the concept of democracy in the Americas come from? Native people had a democracy. And everyone, they operated in consensus. So people had to have a consensus before they did anything. So it's important to understand that we send students to college. One of the reasons we send them to college is so that they will have a set of experiences that will transform their lives and make them into better people. So you're saying to me that you have Native Americans who have a form of government and they have a culture. We learn foods from them, tobacco. We learn the Three Sisters, corn, beans, and squash, and white potatoes. We learn all these things from them and incorporate them into our daily lives, but we don't pay attention to their political structures and their systems.
Yeah, and I think, too, if you want to know what went wrong, it's fascinating to me, and I've always wondered about it, because much of the Constitution, based on the strength of Benjamin Franklin's argument, was indeed based on that Confederacy. Look, there's ways in which you can have a tribal identity, your own state identity, and still act as a nation when it's time. And when you know the difference between when we need to come together and when to act apart, you can navigate this landscape quite well. And they did for about 10,000 years, although I don't know that the Confederacy was alive for the entire 10,000-year period. But there are a few things that you have to probably assume. Number one, we can't own the land, mm-hmm. because then we're going to fight over it. So what we really have to do is kind of be a little bit loose about who can go where and when. And then, when somebody's gone too far, we'll know. So, it does seem to me instructive. If you want to know what went wrong, take a look at what's different about ours and compare it to what was going on there. Yeah. That may be a clue. I can't say definitively.
Yeah,
but
and keep in mind, we know that in the South, for example, we develop a slave system, right? And the planter class, the people who own the slaves, are enriched by slavery, right? So we know in South Carolina, I just took a group of students down to the Association for the Study of African American Life and History Conference to Charleston. And I was actually surprised, but I guess I should not have been, but the students, we went to a slave market, and they were emotional about the slave market and about what had taken place there. And in some of the stones, because slaves were used, children were used to make brick. And so the slave market is built out of the brick. And the children's fingerprints were in the brick. When it was being molded, their fingerprints remain in the brick, even to this day. The point I'm making with that is that the planter class in the South in particular, North Carolina, South Carolina, and the rest of the South, made their monies from the labor of slaves. And many Native people were enslaved first. And then they were mixed with Africans that were brought into the colonies. And they were some of the richest people in the Americas. South Carolina was the richest colony of all 13 colonies at the start of the Revolution. In fact, they were the richest people in the entire world, some of the richest people in the entire world. So the system that they created, they saw this governmental structure that the Indians had, and they chose to remove women from it because women voted, or women basically selected the chiefs within the Native nations, particularly the Iroquois Confederacy. So they chose to remove women from it, not to give them a voice. And then they chose to take from it what they valued in terms of their own democracy, their own equality, right? And use it to create our government. So clearly they created something that was different, but the concept of it and the concept of them having these freedoms, they did see amongst the Indian nations, and it did have some impact on them. But then, of course, they chose to mold it in a way that would suit them. Of course, over time, with the adding of amendments to the Constitution, we are still searching for that perfect democracy in which all people are respected. But again, the influences are there.
Professor Arwin Smallwood is the chair of the Department of History and Political Science at North Carolina A&T State University. Thank you so much for being on the program. We will continue our conversation about blended populations on the state of things, but first the music of Barry Gray.
Well, I've seen them come, I've seen them go from one stale place to another. Any light forbidden from their eyes, oh.